Hi, this is Northport Slade's answer to Hanson, Gary Lactus.
And this is Walthamstow's answer to Hanson. The Beast Must Die, that's
the
right.
The Beast Must Die, yes.
I just thought, you know, I'm so Hanson that I don't need to give my own name anymore.
I, Gary Lactus, of course, are famous for my answer to Bop, which is called Oh Dear.
I'm going to say, oh, shit. you know, in that episode of, no, that issue of Hellblazer where Nurgle the demon makes a sort of conglomerate monster out of all these racist football hooligans, and there's just like this massive, multi-headed, multi-limbed, like skinhead, shouting football chants. I think that Hanson, it'd be good to put Hanson into like one thing, you know, the Hanson thing. Yeah, just this, all these kind of blonde heads. Although, I mean, you know, I think I still think of Hanson as locked in a permanent youth, but of course they're not. I don't think I want to see a picture of them now. We haven't even said what the podcast is.
Oh, and you're listening to the internet's most answer professional to answer to Hanson podcast. Silence!
Yes.
Issue 294. Welcome, dear listener. Welcome, welcome. We're very pleased that you've joined us, because if you hadn't, it would be weird that we were doing this.
Oh, man, I'm just looking at pictures of Hanson now, nowadays. I mean, they're all very handsome in their way.
Hanson,
I'm trying,
yes,
to work out the little one. Oh, the little one.
Yeah. I'm handsome. Do you as remember well, how, by Northport Slade standards.
That's true, yeah. Do you remember how handsome Middle Hanson was? He was a real handsome Hanson.
He was. And little Hanson on the drums.
Yeah.
I remember he would always look at the camera with this sort of really smug look, and I really hated that little shit.
Yeah, well, he's sort
I'm
of...
I'm sure he's fine now.
He's quite a sort of... He's quite a sexy Hanson in his own right. I mean, the other one still looks like a bit of a... Still looks a bit like Julian Cope, and sort of has his big shovel face. I mean, he's just such an older brother, basically.
yeah.
And worryingly, one of them, in a photo I'm looking at, looks a bit like Kenneth Branagh with his beard, but I think that's probably, you know... I'm trying to work out... Oh, I see. It's the littlest Hanson. Looks a bit like Kenneth Branagh. So there you go. And the oldest Hanson is 68 now. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah, of course he is. They've actually aged faster than us.
Yeah. Well, it was part of the spell that they cast to give them temporary global world domination. And
yes, the Bop spell.
The Bop, yes. They got the wizard Bop. He gave them the special. Yeah, but it did age them, and that is very sad. I always liked Hanson, though. Good pop songs. And
yeah. I must play that to Little Barry, actually. I think that's a song that he would certainly enjoy.
Yeah, because I remember always really having a soft spot for that junior-senior song, Everybody. It's like, it's sort of, you know, on paper it's really hateable, but in reality, when you're, if you were drunk and out at like a sort of crap club or something and it came on, it's just a load of fun to dance to, and just sort of got like deceptive number of hooks in it, and just really gets into your skin in a really good way. And it's in the Trolls film, which I have watched legitimately 50 times because my daughter loves it to pieces, and that's good because it's really funny and it's really smart and really excellent as well, as well as being like this kind of neon crazed nightmare. It's got all these kind of slightly tweaked pop songs, and that's in there. And so I was like, oh, yeah, I must play her junior, senior, because she'll dig that. And she'll probably just be like, it's not the Trolls version. But yes, a similarly good pop group, junior, senior, to Hanson. And that's the end of our pop round.
Yes. Well, I think we should maybe move on to your emails. It's
our regular section.
Our regular section, your emails. It just... I've just got up our email account here. Okay. This is an email entitled "For 6 months silence of auto insurance." Livewire. This is from Livewire Insurance. Hi, Livewire Insurance. Thanks for getting in touch. Stop overpaying. See how much you could save on your auto insurance this spring. Rates as low as $19 a month. Get down to the nuts and bolts of top companies by comparing them head-to-head. Get started. Well, I won't do that just now, but that sounds great. Thanks very much. Here we've got leaf filter promotion. Goodbye, clogged gutters. Hello, savings. This is my sort of email. Get rid of gutter problems for good. Get the best deal for you. Save 12% or get $350 off. Get your discount. Say goodbye to gutter cleaning. Unprotected gutters should be cleaned multiple times a year to avoid clogs and prevent home damages. But with leaf filters' completely sealed system, your gutters stay clear and clog-free. And you can stay off the ladder. Oh, I see. It's got a sort of mesh on top that stops crap getting into your gutters. That is a good idea.
It is.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, nothing particularly relating to the podcast here or still comics in general.
I think we can still see that they're fans, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Senior perks. 18 American senior discounts you did not know about. We want to help you take advantage of the many discounts and deals available so you can continue to enjoy your retirement and live your life without any extra costs. Check discounts now. That's good. That's good. And that is kind of relevant, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be retiring at some point, won't we? The Beast Must Die.
Yeah, hopefully soon. You know, with all the money we get from our patrons, we're set to retire by our yacht, yeah. And off we go.
Well, that was a good segue, wasn't it? You can, of course, support us, dear listener, at patreon.com. It justifies it to our wives. And, of course, you get the entire back catalogue of Silence. Lots of exclusive extra podcasts, including Gary Lacter's Prunes and Earth Pig and others. And you get pretty much all of my comics in PDF format. And others. There is more. I'm sure there's more. But surely that's enough for, just a dollar or two a month. That's all right, isn't it? Huh?
It's bloody loads. It's more than anyone could ever want or need, I would say.
Yes, and we're truly, truly grateful to anyone who is a member of C-Unit. That's great. That's that bit of admin. Pretty smoothly done. Mm. Let's segue smoothly into another bit of admin, shall we?
Yes.
No, I was kind of handing you the baton.
Oh, right. Well, I'll tell you what I've got. I've got some news. We don't normally do the news on this, do we? But I've got some news. This is about some comics-related films that are coming up that have been greenlit. But I thought some quite interesting. I mean, it's from a 1990 issue of Speakeasy, but I thought news is news. So, so apparently Bruce Willis's Sergeant Rock film has crumbled. Was set to be made, but he decided to make Hudson Hawk, and we know that goes well, and also that the next Die Hard will be called Die Hardest, and the third in the series is set on a cruise yacht. Looking forward to seeing Die Hardest. The as yet unscripted Modesty Blaze movie is the likeliest to be made, apparently, and Gina Davis is going to be playing Modesty, while Madonna will play some kind of villain. That sounds good, doesn't it? I'm looking forward to that.
Ah, yeah.
Predator 3 is coming out. It's subtitled Earth Invasion, and it's combined to be simultaneously scheduled with Aliens 4, which is good. And this is exciting, not really related to comics, but I guess it's Paul Verhoeven, who directed Robocop and Total Recall. So apparently he is going to show the first erect penis in mainstream cinema for the first time in Women, based on Charles Bukowski's book of the same name. Apparently special effects expert Rob Bottin will create an appropriate prosthetic for the male lead.
Well, then they're not showing a...
Oh. I don't know. Apparently, yeah, so that's
when,
good.
When will I get my erect penis?
And, yeah, so that's some quite interesting news, isn't it? I'm looking forward to quite some of those films.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Like, we could make up a load of shit now that won't happen.
Yeah, well, that's news from the past, informing the future. That's the silence way.
Yeah, news for now. Our sources tell us that there's going to be a Big Lebowski sequel.
Well, I mean, there sort of has been a Big Lebowski sequel. Did you not know
that brilliant Super Bowl advert?
No. There really has. It's not really a sequel, but it's one of the weirdest things. Like John Turturro's character.
I never saw it.
Well, I don't know whether it's available or whether it's come out. I mean, it sounds so weird, and it's like, yeah. I mean, he's a paedophile.
Yes,
really odd.
No, I did hear about that.
Yeah, I think they find a way to say it was like he wasn't. You know, he actually wasn't, and stuff. But it just feels really weird. I guess the Coens probably were like, yeah, we'll sign off on it because they like John Turturro. They've worked with him loads and they're probably just like, meh, whatever. But it's a fucking weird thing. It's like, how about I do a sequel with my one joke character as the hero? It's like, yeah, no. And also, like, 25 years later, whatever it is, you know. Anyway.
Also, Marvel... are going to make another film.
They are. First, they're going to make some television series that is sort of like a film, but it's broken up into chunks. But it's exactly the same as a film, but just with less money. And, that's exciting.
Less money stretched further.
Have
you seen any of that? I haven't.
I've got Disney Plus at my gaff because we have a child, and it is imperative that you have Disney Plus when you have a child because everything is on it. And I have not watched a single Marvel thing on Disney Plus. I have access to every single movie, every single TV show. I have all the Star Wars films and all the Star Wars TV shows. I have not watched any of those either.
No, like me neither. Yeah, I've watched no Marvel TV, no Star Wars.
I watched one episode of The Mandalorian. No Mando. I did watch the first episode of The Mandalorian and I fell asleep before the end, and therefore I judged it harshly.
Last time I went into Dave's Comics of Brighton, there was a guy dressed. I looked at him, it's like, oh, it's a sort of. He's a bit like Boba Fett, but not. Anyway, and people were taking photos of him. He was just a guy who likes dressing up and just happened to go to the comic shop that day. But yeah, it wasn't till later I was like, oh, that was The Mandalorian. Right. Yeah, okay. I'm really out of touch.
We are like a great couple of pop culture nodes. We are really have our finger on the pulse, and we can tell you all the hot news and gossip that you want to hear. I suggest you listen to another podcast if you want that. Maybe House to Astonish. That's a good one. They're very organised and good. You mentioned going to a comic shop. Well, I haven't been to a comic. Actually, I have. I've just remembered. I went to Krypton Comics again. To go through 50p bin diving, and I basically got some stuff, and then I sold it on eBay. I bought it for 50p, and then I sold like a bunch of it on eBay and made like pretty good bank on it. Considering it was 50p, I sold things for like, you know, they sold ended up selling for like 10, 12 quid and stuff, which was quite like, oh, that's pretty nice. That's like a good, because I sort of just was, you know. So one of the things was like Katsuhiro Otomo's Memories, which is a fantastic one shot that he sort of put out, and Epic put out a kind of nice colour comic of it, and it's pretty hard to find, but I've already got it, and I was just like, oh, you know, I'll get that anyway, because either I'll give it to someone, or, you know, maybe it might, and I'll stack it on eBay, and lo and behold, it, you know, people bid on it, and it went up, and I was like, hey, that's nice. So that was an interesting, I never thought, sort of, I haven't really been asked about eBay recently, but I have actually started putting stuff on there and selling some of my stuff where I think it might go, and it's sort of all right, actually, because you sort of just, at first, you watch it really eagerly, like, oh. And then you forget about it, and then suddenly you get a little thing saying, hey, that thing sold. And you're like, oh, excellent, that's fine. but I
and
wasn't...
And then you've got to pay for postage and stuff.
Well, yeah, but you charge for postage, don't you? So I know you always to see the downside. I do know that you always like to try and find some way to see it in a bad light. But trust me, it's only positive.
Yeah. Well, I only say that because I sold some of my comic. I really need to sort out my website, because at the moment you can, like, I don't know, someone bought a bunch of comics.
Oh, did they get a really good deal on the postage by accident?
Yeah,
or something?
Yeah, yeah. They got like half price postage. The postage cost £14. I charged them £7.
Yeah,
but, I mean, £7 to post something. I don't care if they're in Australia. Like, that's too much money. I don't want to charge someone that.
Oh, well,
really?
That's silly.
I think I'd sooner pay the other, you know, £7. Really, just to get the bloody comics out from under my dining room table.
Yeah.
Dining room. Dining corner.
Dining room.
Yeah. Dining corner of lounge. Yeah. Where the table is. Anyway, wait, sorry, yeah. Carry on.
Yeah, no, all I was going to say is that I did go to a comic shop, but I also got another load of comics. I got a nice lawn bomb through the post.
Mm.
But I'm not just going to tell you about it. I've pre-recorded a segment about it because, you know, the listeners, they love our unboxings. It's one of the biggest hits of silence.
Yes.
So, Gary Lactus, roll the tapes.
I'm pressing play now. Click.
For public safety and personal economics, it's time to listen to the Beast Unboxing Comics.
Hi, gang. It's your old pal, the Beast Must Die, here. And I'm here with a very special feature that I know all the young people in the audience are a big fan of these. So we're doing another Lorne Brown
unboxing.
Lorne Brown, as you may or may not know, is my tat benefactor. A mysterious, unworldly presence who hovers around boot fairs and second-hand shops and charity shops, hoovering up all sorts of incredible treats and then sells them at an incredibly reasonable price to tat-hungry fiends like me. And in the absence of really being to get, you know, getting to go into comic shops or charity shops and root around in the 50p bins, it is my main source of comics joy at the moment, receiving these. Possibly need to get my tat spending a little bit in check, but, you know, whatever. World's going to end, so, you know, who really cares? But, yeah, so I thought, you know, me and Gary always providing content. That's our motto. It's what's going to be etched on our collective grave. And so with no further ado, here's some hot content for you. Right, this has come in a box, an actual box. Some newspaper and padding there, because there's comics of different shapes and sizes, so he wants to make sure that they're not getting bashed up. Also, there's some highly valuable items in here, at least for me anyway. Right at the top here we have, very exciting, the first issue of V for Vendetta, the DC reprint. I've been having collected my full Watchmen set. I'm now working through my V for Vendetta set, because there's just certain comics where you think, actually, I really want like a pristine set of those original comics, as well as the collections, just because they are sort of totemic landmarks in my life, and also just fucking great comics. So yeah, this is number one. It means I think I've only got a couple more to get, like 2 and 5 maybe, and then I'll have a full 10 issue run of V for Vendetta. This is lovely. It's an absolutely beautiful copy, and he sourced it for me and got it for me for a very reasonable price. This is one of those comics that can pass hands for silly money, so really happy with that. That's well nice. And the other thing that's nice about these V for Vendetta issues is that they've got things that aren't in the collection. They've got like Mitch Jenkins for photographs on the back cover, sort of atmospheric photographs. Mitch Jenkins, long-term collaborator with Alan Moore. And you've got like David Lloyd sort of images turned into these interstitial chapter titles, blown up, kind of nice black and white on single colour pages, very sort of graphically strong. Nice bits on the inside and outside. No adverts. Oh, it's all, it's just really nice. So, you know V for Vendetta, though. Right, I've got an issue of Adventures of Captain America, Sentinel of Liberty, which I have been interested in before, mainly because it's drawn somewhat by, I don't know if he did the whole series, but by Kevin Maguire. At least it was originally supposed to be. This is the 4th issue. This was like a prestige format Marvel comic. It doesn't look like Kevin Maguire is drawing this issue though. Steve Carr and Kevin West. Yeah, with Kevin Maguire listed as a storyteller. So I think, you know, Maguire is one of those artists who is really, really good, but perhaps I wonder if he struggles with deadlines. He did amazingly well on Justice League. All those lovely facial expressions and amazing stuff. But yeah, I was recommended to read this as a kind of an example of a really like awful comic in that I think this deals with Captain America and maybe some sort of Auschwitz related business. Now, normally that's reserved for car crash merchants like Mark Miller, but this is Fabian Nicieza, done in the early 90s. Looks like it's got Captain America and the Red Skull fighting in an arena as well, which is interesting. And a load of emaciated-looking prisoners of war tooling up with machine guns to fight Nazis. Let's see how that reads. Pretty weird. An issue of the Valkyrie Press original run of Luther Arkwright, The Adventures of Luther Arkwright, Brian Talbot's signature work, and a like really key kind of cornerstone of that whole bridge between sort of Michael Moorcock, Jerry Cornelius, and the comics world. Luther Arkwright was a very a love letter to Jerry Cornelius, very much in the spirit of those early Moorcock books, but is a kind of fantastic dimension hopping vision of England, framed through the adventures of the titular Luther Arkwright. Beautiful black and white art by Brian Talbot, and is kind of him really finding his feet in, you know, he kind of went from being like a head comics-y sort of artist on stuff like Reverb Storm, Chester Hackenbush and all that. And then he kind of moved into this more fantasy and sci-fi, but kind of hard-edged, and lots of period detail. There's like this kind of Victoriana and lots of Catholic imagery and stuff that you can see why Pat Mills sort of thought he would be a really good follow-up to Kevin O'Neill on Nemesis. Very, very different artist, but there's a similar sort of grotesqueness and a powerful loathing of the Catholic Church. I think means that, or just the just church in general, organized religion, that probably puts him in a good place. Anyway, this is like issue 5. I think I've just need one more, and then I've got a full set of 9 of these. I mean, I have read it before. It's just it's such a great comic. Right, next up, prestige format. You know I love them. Batman Full Circle. This is Mike W. Barr and Alan Davis's sequel to their amazing Batman Year Two, which is a sort of good bad comic of some repute. Like it's mainly known because it came after Batman Year One. It was called Year Two, but I think it was originally conceived not as a, you know, the second year of Batman's career. I think it was originally called like Batman 1980, which is a sort of kind of a cool title. Someone should do something with that. But after the success of Year One, they ran a four-part series called Year Two, which was the first part of it was drawn by Alan Davis. And then Todd McFarlane picked up the reins and drew the next three, I think, probably because Davis was like working on Excalibur or something, but he had been collaborating with Mike Barr on Detective Comics, a really fun and underrated run actually, which sort of at a time when Miller's grit was really like in favour, Mike Barr took it in a much more different kind of colourful and comical and kind of wacky tone almost, which went really well with Alan Davis's lovely cartooning. And it's a really nice run. But anyway, they then did this really absurdly violent Year Two comic, which featured a character called the Reaper, who is just, oh my God, I mean, he's so bad. He's got a skull mask, red studded leather outfit, a big black cape, and two massive scythes for fists. And also his scythe fists sometimes open up and guns come out, machine guns come out. And just a really weird moment in Bat history, because by all accounts, if we're to believe it, that was the second year of Batman's career. So after the sort of quasi-noir 1940s feel of Year One, it was like, yep, here's Mr. Scythes and Guns. He's the next threat. But also, apparently, this was like a vigilante that predated Batman, which is fucking weird when you think about it. It's like, oh right, so Gotham was like, yeah there was this guy called the Reaper, he had machine guns for hands and massive size and a skull mask, but yeah, no, the guy who turned out like a bat, that's the real shocker, the bat guy. That's when Gotham City really took notice. Anyway, Full Circle is the sequel that came out in about 1991. And it's the main reason I wanted this is partly because I love the old prestige formats, and partly because I just love Alan Davis and a whole 64 pages of Alan Davis or 48 pages or whatever it is a flipping treat. And, you know, my appreciation for the sort of kitsch and camp quality of something like Year Two has grown. I think, you know, when I was a kid, I read it. I was like, I'm just so hungry to read any Batman that I was like, yeah, this is all good. But then I got ashamed of it and thought, this is really shit, because I realised how much worse it was than something like Miller. But then I've come back around again now, and I like a good bit of ripe cheddar in my Batman stories. And Full Circle is an extremely ripe bit of cheddar. Now, what's here? Oh, yeah. Ha-ha. Right, interesting. I've got the Blair Witch comic that came out. Now, this is sealed with a certificate of authenticity. It's number 272. So this is when they thought that these would be obviously, you know, highly sought after items. But first of all, I mean, I love the Blair Witch Project. One of the great horror films. One of the, you know, a turning point in cinema in general. Still holds up remarkably well. Like, just a really interesting. And the comics that were put out by Oni Press to cash in on it were actually like surprisingly good. They were written by Jen Van Meter, who's a novelist who has dabbled in comics. But they were illustrated. What they did is they sort of took bits of the lore that was touched upon in the film and then spun short stories out of them. And there was a couple of original pieces as well. So the first one, Ellie Kedwood's Curse, is drawn in by Tommy Lee Edwards in his lovely blocky sort of almost like wood. I mean, it's very much kind of post Mazzucchelli, post Alex Toth, strong black and white, but it's great. I mean, it's lovely, really nice. And then you've got a fantastic period one called She Needs Me, Coffin Rock, which is drawn by Guy Davis. I mean, you don't need any information to know that Guy Davis is just one of the greats, and he has left the industry in disgust to make lots of money as a creature designer in Hollywood, as he should. But any Guy Davis work is worth getting. And
this one deals with the Coffin Rock murder, which is alluded to, and that was creepy. That's a creepy bit of work. And then the final one is by Bernie Moreau, which deals with the Rustin Parr killing. So these are all bits that are alluded to in the lore. And part of the appeal of Blair Witch was that there was this sort of lore they built up through websites and books and dossiers and things that we kind of created this sense of reality about the myth. And this kind of really fits in with that nicely. It's actually just a really incredibly high quality comic. Normally these things are not. They are usually crass rubbish cash-ins, and this isn't. Then I've got a issue of Excalibur, part of the Cross Time Caper. I love Excalibur. It's one of the few X comics I actually like, and I really only like it when Alan Davis is drawing it. I actually like, people like the Alan Davis run where he wrote and drew it, and I do too, but I really enjoy Davis and Claremont together. I think the density and weird kinkiness of Claremont's scripting is brought into a real joyous life by Alan Davis's clear storytelling and cartooning chops, and he draws amazing looking superheroes. I fancy Alan Davis's women more than any others in comics, and I just love Excalibur. I love its quirky English, sort of English oddness, and yeah, it's just always fun. So happy with that. Got an issue of Lords of the Ultra Realm by Doug Monch and Pat Broderick. A 6-issue, I think, miniseries from DC in, I think, 1986. A new format. Or is it deluxe format? Who knows? But anyway, don't really know anything about this. Just always saw the advert, and I'm just fascinated by those comics where they were kind of original properties that came out in the wake of things like Watchmen and Dark Knight and other things doing so well, where they were like, yeah, let's just take a chance on all these original properties, these sort of and DC just had a whole slew of these in the 80s that were just really interesting. They often make for quite bad comics, but I'm just fascinated by it, and this seems like some kind of cobbled together fantasy sort of job with lots of skeleton warriors and blonde mulleted barbarian types, possibly existing in the modern world from the looks of things. Just looks really dumb and fun. It probably will be awful, but I never regret buying things like that. Then I've got an issue of 2000 AD, which is Prog 536. And the reason I got this is because it has Brendan McCarthy and Steve Yeowell cover for Zenith, phase one. And it's episode... It's the first episode, which is great. Obviously, I've got Zenith in many forms in other ways, but I just like to pick up some of the old progs where there's like a good cover or a specific, you know, strong issue. And this was a really good time for Dread as well, for 2000 AD, the sort of 500s, an excellent time. There's some Tyranny Rex in there by John Smith and lots of other nice things. There's always some Strontium Dog. But yeah, just a lovely Steve Yeowell and Brendan McCarthy sort of pop art cover. Great. I've got some issues of Comics World, the Comic World, which is a comic magazine that ran in the 90s. It was available in newsagents. And I think it's Steve Holland from Page 45 who edits it, which I didn't realise at the time. And it's just really good. I love old comics, comic magazines and things, because they're just really great to get a kind of a reminder of the sort of landscape at the time. You get like lots of nice reviews. And my favourite thing is news of things that are upcoming that never made it. So with a bit of hindsight, you're like, yeah, that didn't happen. But I love seeing all the kind of, stuff that Frank Miller was apparently going to release or whatever, or Neil Gaiman, or all these projects that never happened. And it's just always fun, and just lots of good interviews and articles and things like that. Always fun. And Comic World, I think, was the magazine that hosted a couple of notorious Grant Morrison interviews, which I love, coupled with Mark Miller as well, where they're just behaving like absolute dickheads, but in a really fun way. So yeah, that's good. two issues of Miracle Man, the Eclipse run. This is 23 and 24. These were, again, I got these for a really good price, considering they go for a lot of money. But this is the only two bits of Miracle Man I don't have. So I've got the Eclipse trades of book 1, 2, and 3 and the Golden Age. So the four volumes that Eclipse put out. And then the Silver Age, which Gaiman was starting to work on with Mark Buckingham, only got two issues, and then everything went tits up with Eclipse, and apparently they're working on finishing it. But yeah, fat chance, basically. It sits with Marvel at the moment. I think I've discussed on a previous episode, Miracle Man is a cursed superhero, so I doubt we'll ever see these. But these two issues, that kind of completes my Miracle Man collection. And I think that Neil Gaiman's work on Miracle Man is like some of the only stuff that I'm almost completely uncritical of in some ways. I can still find fault, don't worry, but I've always wanted to read those two issues as well. So then I've got some more issues of this is a new obsession, the 90s. I'm quite into the 90s in DC now, the kind of weird fringe stuff that was being put out. They're kind of unsuccessful revamps of characters. And one of them was the Challenge of the Unknown comic. They're a bit of a cursed group. There's been a lot of attempts to revamp them after Kirby's original. And there's no reason that the challenges shouldn't work. I love the idea of the original idea of like three guys who are essentially escaped death and then decided that they're almost addicted to the thrill of escaping death. So they start, you know, exploring the outer limits of human experience and adventure. But the 90s revamp was a much more post-X-Files take. But the main reason I like it is, so it's kind of non-superheroic, really. It's all very sort of ground-level, supernatural stuff. But mainly interested because the issues, early issues, were drawn by Tommy Lee Edwards, aforementioned, and Jean-Paul Leon, who's also that wonderful sort of stripped down black and white artwork. And obviously Jean-Paul Leon really sadly died at the age of 49, and was like one of the great comic artists, really, of the 90s and the 2000s, and that's a real shame. I remember his first work on like Static and RoboCop Prime Suspect and things, and seeing his development as an artist was like, you know, amazing. He just got so good. And RIP. That's really shit. I'm sad you're dead. And now, six issues of Michael Moorcock's Multiverse, which is an anthology that came under the Helix banner, which was an imprint, a sci-fi themed imprint. It was going to be called Matrix originally, but then had to be renamed because of the Matrix. And so it became Helix. And this was an attempt like Milestone and Vertigo, where you sort of have an imprint within DC, and the focus was completely on sci-fi themed comics. The most successful thing that came out of that was Transmetropolitan by Warren Ellis, prime shithead, apparently. Warren Ellis. And then there were some other things like Cyberella by Howard Chaykin and all sorts of odd things. Matt Howarth did something. Dave Gibbons did there was all sorts of odd comics that came out. Some of them are worth a look. And I've always been interested by this. This was what Walt Simonson essentially oversaw, an anthology based upon Michael Moorcock properties. And he worked with Moorcock on this, and he actually drew a bunch of stuff. He drew like one of the strips, and I love Walt Simonson. And in the sort of 90s, he's firing on all cylinders. This is around the time he did the Orion series, which is fantastic. And really intrigued by this. And then you've got Mark Reeve doing some work on another issue. I mean, it's like really good, high quality work as well. John Ridgway. Just a really interesting looking anthology, really. Moonbeams and Roses is one story. The Metatemporal Detective and Duke Elric. Those are the three stories. And I think it ran for 12 issues, and this is like the first six. So very interested by that. Here's an issue of Dr. Fate, the recent series, most recent series, which is written by Paul Levitt and drawn by Brendan McCarthy. And much as I dislike McCarthy's stance on a lot of stuff and his odious politics and his general sort of arsehole persona online, I've talked many times about how disappointed I am by that. He still remains one of my all-time favourite artists, and Dr. Fate is one of my all-time favourite characters in a way that's odd, considering that I don't really... I mean, I'd like the DeMatteis run, and I love the Giffen miniseries from the 80s, but I don't seek out Dr. Fate wherever he is. I just love him. Ever since Justice League International, I've always just loved the design of the character and the name, and just, you know, this kind of odd... I love these kind of mystic, supernatural DC characters, and this is McCarthy in his kind of modern, heavily computer influenced style. But you know, I can't resist a little bit of Dr. Fate drawn by him, even though I don't expect it's very good. And you know, I do slightly resent the fact that I've given him more money. I'm not really, but you know what I mean. Two issues of Blast, the 90s British anthology, newsstand anthology, which was put out by John Brown, who were publishing Speakeasy, the comics review, the comic kind of criticism and review magazine. And they put out Blast, which was their attempt to sort of join the adult comics market. Most notoriously, the place that Warren Ellis's Lazarus Churchyard was first appeared, and drawn by Disraeli. I love his art in this so much, and I think Lazarus Churchyard is my favourite Warren Ellis comic, mainly because of Disraeli, and also just because it feels very much like Warren Ellis's interests, but less info dumpy and annoying. It's more imaginative, far flung, hard sci-fi. Yeah, it's just great. I love Lazarus Churchyard, but just mainly because I think Disraeli is one of the greatest British comic artists of all time. Torpedo reprints from, you know, Jordi Benet, like that's never bad. Big Bertha, which was a kind of another original strip, sort of post Tank Girl, sex and violence, sort of sci-fi stuff. Not great, but I quite like the art by Jan Szymany. I always thought that was pretty good. And then you've got some, you know, an interview with J.G. Ballard, reprint of some Concrete by Paul Chadwick. It's a bit of a grab bag, but it's nice, and it's a big magazine size thing. Some reviews. So the Speakeasy element sort of found its way, because Speakeasy folded, but it found its way into the comic. And then you've got some Peter Bag. I mean, it's odd. It's not a surprise it didn't work out, really. But, there's a Dave Hine there. Dave Hine comic, that's nice. Called Curse of the Transvestite. I wonder how well that's aged. Dave Hine's pretty great, though, so I trust him. I do trust him. It's just that particular area is an area that is evolving quickly. So things done in the 90s may well not look great. But... yeah, it's not a surprise that Blast didn't work out, really, because it's a real odd thing. But at the same time, it's pretty great, and it cost me 50p. And then I've got a few issues of, I think, four issues. I don't know whether there was six in total. I feel like there was, but anyway, it's issues 1-4 of Grey Shirt, Indigo Sunset, part of the ABC Comics line. But this was written, this was the great Grey Shirt, which was like Alan Moore's spirit homage. Never really stepped out from under the shadow fully of it, but this is written and drawn by Rick Veitch, and he's become, like, in time, like, one of my most favourite creators, and I'm always fascinated by stuff that he worked on where he's writing and drawing it, because he finds a way to bring odd personal visions to even the most corporate properties. And this is obviously not, this is like, you know, Alan Moore's pet project, and Moore obviously is a long-term collaborator with him, and it looks like there's tons of fun stuff in here, and I never gave it a chance at the time because I was like, oh, it's not written by Alan Moore, but now I'm like, yeah, gimme. So we shall see. It might be good. I hope it is. It's certainly nice to look at. I love Rick Veitch. He's fucking great. And then that is your lot. Yeah, a couple more comic worlds in there. My God, I got a lot of those. But that is quite a significant treat of a haul there. I'm going to look forward to digging my way through the good and the bad there. But anyway, hope that's been mildly diverting for you, and you can at least get the visceral thrill of getting a load of comics, but secondhand, and not having to worry about the fact that you've now got a load of stuff to find space for in your ever diminishing allocated space that's allowed for comics in your life. So you can just worry about me doing that instead, and just enjoy the sensation of an unboxing. So yeah, I hope that was good, and I'll return you to the regular schedule programming.
Unboxing.
Oh, wasn't that great? I actually haven't listened to all. I was listening to it just before we started recording, so I have heard half of it, and what a load of tat that was.
It gets really shit towards the second half, though. That goes really bad. But the listeners already know that. So,
right. Well, I mean, while we're on that, I did see Lorne today, and I picked up... I have stopped buying... I've pretty much stopped buying stuff that, you know, maybe I wanted once, or stuff that would fill gaps. And I'm just buying weird shit now.
Yeah, it's the way to go.
I got a bunch of copies of a British comic called Champ. Do you remember Champ?
I don't.
I didn't either. I was like, wow. But it's I don't know, I'm flicking through it for the first time here. Mixture of humour and adventure. I don't know if it's IPC or... or DC Thompson.
Yeah, some renegade third publisher.
The Space Castaways. What we got in here? Champ, United Sensation, Joe Pearson in pre-match punch-up. Kidnap Capers with the Kingsway Kids. Wow, lots of alliteration. Champ, Cold Steel Killers from the Past in the Sinister World of Mr. Pendragon. Oh, that looks quite good, actually. There's a sort of a Celt on a horse about to do in a policeman. And, yeah, this is proper, like, you know, everybody's uncredited British comics. Kill All Those Who Live Here. Dennis the... Oh, OK, this is a DC Thompson thing because there's Dennis the Menace doing a guest here. You got Kids Rule OK.
Really?
But not that Kids Rule OK.
Oh,
that's odd. Right, so there we go. That's fun. Let's get... what have I got? I got the issue one of Everything, which I really enjoyed, written by Christopher Chantwell with art by I.N.J. Coulbard. That was a great sort of overused phrase, but kind of relevant here. Lynchian little mini-series. I'm hoping that comes back. I really enjoyed that. And, you know, Ian Coulbard, that'll make...
He's good.
That'll make me happy doing whatever, pretty much.
Yeah.
I've got issues 1-4 of By Night, John Allison, and with art by Christine Larson and Sarah Stern. A fun sort of parallel universe thing, which I've read most of, but I didn't own the comics. And do you know what? John Allison, he deserves bigging up, really.
Oh, yeah.
Because of all of the excellent appearances he's done on Silence to Astonish. And I always think anyone who suffers a silence to astonish should be supported by us, or at least read. I got a copy of Gary Lineker's Hot Shot every Monday, 15th of October, 1988. It's actually got quite a few actual comics in it. Family Fortune, the football mad family from the rough side of town. And you've got Andy Steele, playmaker. Who, that's more sort of, no, that's some football. There's a strip here called Magic Man. And that's got some, looks like there's lots of football. there's some really nice pictures of Gary Lineker here. Kick off with Gary's newest challenge, Gary Lineker. To be honest, my heart didn't soar when I looked at that at this. but there is, and
I'm
also
quite fascinated by the football comic thing, though, because it is a massive.
It is a comic as well. It's a comic, and it's not Roy of the Rovers.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, well, there was. I think there was like a few, wasn't there? There was, but I mean, it was like a huge part of like boys' comics in the 70s and 80s was football stuff. And I remember getting on a kind of one of those train journeys or like school holiday things where it's like I don't know, I was going to London or something, and my mum getting me some comics, and I think it was like I think I got a like Roy of the Rovers comic, and it had like a Mexico 86 World Cup sticker book in it. And I then went on to collect all of the, well, most of those stickers, even though I didn't give a shit about it really. And I remember that was the year that like Gary Lineker was in and stuff. And I remember getting a Gary Lineker, and it was like an England, I was always excited to get an England sticker, and I got Gary Lineker. And I was like, who's Gary Lineker? It's not Kevin Keegan. Ozzy Ardiles or any of the ones that I knew, and then anyway, but I do remember like quite enjoying, like I sort of was a bit like, I mean, I don't really like this comic because it's not really what I want, but it did have some quite good strips in it. I remember there was one like Mighty Mouse Hot Shot and Mighty Mouse. It was like, yeah, it was really, it had like really good like kind of overblown artwork, and it was like, yeah, it was quite cool. I'd quite like to relaunch Roy of the Rovers and just do loads of weird football strips, like
has it not been relaunched a
yeah
lot?
Yeah, but I don't care, but I mean that'll just be shit because it'll be like serious. I'm talking about me relaunching Roy of the Rovers with all my ideas about football strips. Like my main one is called
completely badly informed.
Yeah, exactly. Like
no, don't have a clue.
Football knowledge. I had one strip called Cosmic Boots, which I thought would be good about a boy who is enlisted to play like in a kind of interdimensional football game against all sorts of like crazy aliens with like incredibly high stakes and like this really wild version of like football on Alien, a bit like Secret Wars really, but with football. I thought that'd be quite good, get like some really crazy art and stuff, so all that sort of stuff. Haunted Boots about boys possessed by undead footballer or something, I don't know, loads of good stuff.
Robot Boots,
exactly.
The Haunted Ball.
Girl Boots, about a girl who plays football. Can you imagine?
That one
would never fly with the lads. The lads would never stand for that.
Absolutely not. Oh, I also got a bunch of copies of Shoot, which has got virtually no... It's just like a sort of football news for kids. that's absolutely no use for me whatsoever.
I bet you can get some use out of it, though.
Flicking through it, there's some fantastic haircuts here.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have just sent you a photo that I've literally just found.
Hold on, let me just have a look. Hold on, I'm just looking. Oh, yeah, there we go.
Dave Sexton. Friendly persuader. That's all it says. I have no idea what this article is about. It's about something to do with football, but there's just this quite large photo of a smiling man in a polo neck,
smiling kind of tasty
jumper. Dave Sexton, friendly persuader.
Just looks very menacing.
Jimmy Armfield, diplomatic and astute. Ron Greenwood, schoolmaster type. Ali McLeod, Muhammad Ali of football.
The Muhammad Ali of football. Unpack that, please. Let's go. Let's find a bit more detail.
And I mean, there's some other stuff that I will talk about. And I got a copy of Herbie, which is good.
What, the Fat Fury?
The Fat Fury, yeah.
That's a very weird and good comic.
Always good and bizarre. Look forward to reading that.
Well, yes, very good.
But, like, you know, no seminal works of the early 90s or anything like that. Just like, all just like weird shit, basically, in my hall. And I'll make a jingle now so it sounds professional. Yeah. That was Gary's lawn bum. Kapow! Bang! Whoa! Look out! Marvellous. That's okay. We've done a sort of customary near half hour of preamble.
Yep.
Anything else?
No, I think we should get straight to the meat and potatoes. I mean, with my bit as well that was there, that's about an hour already. We're an hour in, basically. So let's listen to ourselves talk about comics in another place.
Yes, a completely different place.
Let us go.
Come with us to Review Universe with Gary and the Beast and you, of course.
Yeah, so comics, eh? We like them, like them, dear listener. Let's talk them about them.
Let's talk to them.
Hello, comic. How are you? I'm fine, thanks. I'm... what are you? I'm The Young Lawyers, issue 2 from Dell Comics, 1971. Never read any Dell comics before.
Never read any lawyer comics before.
No. And, like, young lawyers, that's sort of... I feel like I'm young at heart. I thought, this is the comic for me. But, of course, Dell Comics did... they sort of specialised in licensing TV shows. And doing sort of reasonably... basic comics based on those TV shows, and I think they universally had photo covers. So this is a picture of the characters in the Young Lawyers. Doesn't have the names of the characters. They're sort of sat down. There's a young lady, a sort of middle-aged man with a cigar, and a young chap, and young lady is Judy Pace. The middle-aged man is Lee J. Cobb.
Oh yeah,
and
that's an actor.
Exactly. They're the actors' names. They're not the characters' names. So it's just like it's got the credits on the front. Zalman King, and they're in sort of odd sort of. Small writing, like it sort of reeks of contractual obligation.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
sort of like using the likenesses, and then for a comic that is based on a TV show, which is, you know, played by real actors, it's still in the indicia, has all rights reserved. Blah blah blah. The events contained herein are fictional, and any resemblance to any person, living or dead, is purely coincidental. So there we go. I mean, that's just admitting that you've drawn this pretty badly. Surely.
I'd hate to do. I mean, I would. You're doing a lot of reference work at the moment in your commissioning life, but yeah. I would hate. to draw a tie-in comic. It's so like hard to do that thing. I mean, I think Dave Gibbons pulled it off really well with his Doctor Who comics. But apparently he did, I think he used like a model or something. I don't know. He actually did have a sort of 3D Tom Baker head that he used, you know, typically sort of thorough. But he pulled it off because it sort of looked like a Dave Gibbons drawing, but it really looked like Tom Baker. But there's that weird, those Star Wars comics where, you know, what was his name? Sal, oh, I can't remember. Oh, he's a Marvel artist, something. He draws loads of shit, but he drew the Star Wars stuff and it was all just like painfully like obvious photo referencing and then just his normal shit, and it just looked really like weird and stiff, wrong. Yeah, it'd just be a ball ache. you've got to draw like oh no, yeah, just annoying. But it's really fun when people do it and they do it badly, though. That's also good.
Yeah, I have to say I did really enjoy reading this comic.
I'm sure you did.
earlier today. It's got two stories in it, for a start. That's good. I mean, it's such a funny idea, isn't it? Like, you've got a TV show, which is probably, you know, it's probably like, 45 minutes long. I never saw The Young Lawyers, a TV show. And that's like a sort of... That's going to be some sort of parody of... nothing like the actual life of a lawyer the way that Columbo is, nothing the like way, the life of a police detective.
In the way that Diagnosis Murder is nothing like the life of a roller skating paediatric, doctor.
Yeah.
No, he's not a paediatric doctor, is he, anyway?
Doesn't he do all? Oh no, that's Quincy. Quincy is the pathologist, isn't
he? Yeah, pathologist. Yeah, but that is, all pathologists' life is like that. They all go on yachts and caress sexy young girls when they're not looking at corpses.
Yes, before their latest job, before their
on their yachts
autopsy. and then just the idea of, like, you take that. And then, like, you add this extra layer of, like, converting it to a comic, which is, like, you have to condense these stories even more. No idea who wrote it, no idea who drew it.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I expect there's probably a site somewhere where someone has documented who did it, or at least done a best guess. Such a weird thing to exist. It's like, The Young Lawyers is my favourite TV show. We don't have video recorders. I want more of the Young Lawyers, and so I'm going to buy the Young Lawyers comic. Like, I really like Neighbours.
You would buy the Neighbours comic. You would buy the shit
out of that. I'd be drawing the fucker. But I mean, that's a bad example. But I don't know. All right, Casualty. Love Casualty on a Saturday night, but it's only once a week. If only I could get more Casualty in my life. And Casualty is sort of really set up. Like, it's got that format. Like, you know, you're introduced to a character. Something bad's going to happen to that character. That character goes into hospital. They live or they die.
Basically,
like, you could do a great Casualty comic, actually.
Yeah. Basically, Casualty, Midsummer Murders, all these types of programme that masquerade as, like, incredibly middle-brow or, you know, just a very homely Saturday or Sunday entertainment. They're just basically constructed like horror films and often use lots of motifs from horror in the way that they're constructed. So you get these real, like, okay, here's a person that she's a successful young professional. She's on her way to meet her friend for a game of squash. And you're just watching it going, how's she going to get really fucked up? How's she going to get really fucked up? It's just like a horror film. It's like, you know she's going to get hurt. She doesn't know she's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
It's that Hitchcockian thing of, like, you know,
a windpipe's going to get crushed by
a speeding creative
squash ball.
Yeah.
Or what? Yeah.
You know, and it's just so funny that it kind of, it, you know, people who watch Casualty would never like acknowledge that what they're doing is the same as me watching some spam in a cabin slasher film. But it is, really. It's just the same impulses.
I wonder what it's like writing Casualty. Do you think they have, like, obviously, for the main body of it, they have a sort of panel of medical experts, you know, medical experts, and you've got some, like, you know, some soap writer people. But for the beginning bit, I think, like, they must just have, like, a bunch of sadists in a cage. Just dreaming up terrible things to happen to people.
Well, it's like Midsummer Murders is just full of, like, you know, the whole tone of Hot Fuzz, which was like, what if this, you know, parochial ultimate English village was actually full of, you know, bloodthirsty murdering and killing. I mean, that is just Midsummer Murders. That's what goes on in every episode of Midsummer Murders. Like, there's always something like the vicar's wife getting shot at an archery competition or something. And it's just really gruesome, but really, like, cuddly as well. And, yeah, I'm a real sucker for that shit. I'm like, yeah, this is great. It's like tea time horror. It's really weird.
So obviously the young
Midsummer lawyers, Murders comic, I would love that. A Midsummer Murders anthology, that would be so good.
Oh. Omnibus
presented by Nettles.
written and drawn by dead-eyed soulless people who are having an awful time.
Yeah using tablets and Photoshop, you know, like in the modern parlance of the way that all the 2000 AD art look, has this real sort of like everyone's using their computers now, and it just sort of, it feels like there's a sort of house style. You just want that house style like repeated basically in like in the Midsummer Murders comic. It must look as kind of as little character as possible, basically, in it. It's got to just be like, yeah.
So the young lawyers, the first story here, I'll just talk about the first story because the second one is not so good. But it's funny because I get the feeling that Del is a fairly conservative operation.
Probably, yeah.
And they deal with, this is about a hippie. And this hippie, who rides a bike and has, he's got fairly long hair, a moustache, dark glasses, Stars and Stripes helmet. Like, this is, they've taken the character straight out of Easy Rider, you know. It's like some straight conservative guys have watched Easy Rider and tried to sort of figure out what it's about. And I mean, I'm not a straight conservative guy. And I mean, I don't really know what Easy Rider's about. I think it's a bit rubbish, but you know.
I mean, I know what it's about. I just don't enjoy it very much. It's like,
yeah.
It's, you know.
Yeah, well, all right, yeah, the point of it. I don't really get what the point of it was.
The point is that the man will crush you eventually, whatever you do.
And this is a sort of summary of that. You've got this guy, he's... he calls himself Captain Freedom, and he obviously looks a bit different to the people in this sort of town just outside of Boston. And but he meets a level of discrimination which is I really don't think is representative of what it is. Just everything. This guy goes in any place and he's like, move it, pal. We don't need any more business today. Just hop on that thing of yours and there and pop off. Get a load of the freak. Ain't them bums disgusting? They shouldn't be allowed to use public places.
Like, I mean, this is
literally everyone is from the 50s and hates this hippie.
This is literally First Blood. I mean, it is just like, that is how Rambo First Blood starts. It's exactly that, basically.
Oh, is it really? I've never seen it.
I've never seen it? Oh, well, it's very good. But, I mean, it's just, he just turns up in a small town and he's just a drifter, you know, on his way through. And Brian Denner, he's the local sheriff, and he just keeps like picking him up in his car and escorting him out of town and basically giving him these really horrible, stern, friendly lectures and stuff. But it's exactly this, basically. It's exactly
Oh, maybe Stallone read this comic.
I think, well, I think that's what we're getting at, although you know, it's not actually written by Stallone, okay? It's based on a novel, all right? So just get it right or shut up.
Okay.
Anyway, right. Sorry,
well,
carry on.
Perhaps that novelist read this comic.
I think that's more like it, yeah.
Yeah, you're a crummy bum, you're not a human, you're a freak, a lousy freak! Oh, let him go, the bum, he ain't no good for nothing, let him go. And so he cycles down the highway, and then there's some truckers, and they just decide to run him over because he's a hippie. Literally swerve and get and run him over, and they run him off the road.
Too right.
You can tell he's injured because he's got a plaster on his cheek now. And he goes to, they've judged me long enough. Now it's my turn. And then he goes to the young lawyer's office. And he wants to sue the people. Because everywhere he goes, the people of the United States tried to kill me. Then there's the young lawyer here with the... He's got fairly long hair. I mean, it's sort of big and curly. But he's wearing sort of a checked suit. He looks like a used car salesman. He's like, Aaron, this is Captain Freedom. At least that's what he calls himself, I heard. And then they need to... So this young lawyer follows him around to see if they can build a case. The girl one does some admin. The lawyer sees the persecution he faces everywhere he goes. In this ridiculously ramped up depiction of inequality. Which is, it's kind of pointing in the wrong direction. Eventually, the hippie guy, Captain Freedom, goes in to collect some stuff from a friend where he's leaving some stuff, leaving the lawyer with the bike. And these sort of buzz cut jocks start on the lawyer, thinking like he's a hippie.
Oh, man.
And start like laying into him and stuff. So you got a bit of action, got a bit of fisticuffs there. But the hippie then comes back and chases them off. And do you know how it ends? He's decided not to sue the American people because someone has shown him, reached out and shown him compassion, which is the young lawyers. I mean, I don't know how they get paid ever, but...
You're not going to get any money out of old Captain Freedom, are you? You'd probably more like to just get the soggy end of a joint or some sort of hippie doodad.
Yeah. And it turns out that the hippie was actually... he had a master's degree in philosophy. He did. He served in the military, in the US Marines... Two tours in Vietnam with a Silver Star for bravery and two Purple Hearts. So how can people just judge someone? How can people judge someone just by the way they look? I hope that young man finds the answer to that question, Aaron. I hope we all do. So it's all right because he was a soldier.
Yeah, no, he served the people. Yeah, they never judge a book by its cover. That's what they say. I mean, I'm not joking. That is literally the plot of First Blood, except for instead of the lawyer following him around, he goes into the woods, fucks up an entire like police force, then takes out an entire National Guard, basically, and blows up an entire town, pretty much. But it's broadly the same, essentially, because he's also a vet. And, you know, he's basically, it's all about America looking at what it's created and saying, you know, you made these killing machines and now you're rejecting them. It's actually like quite a poignant film in amongst all the like people getting smacked in the face by tree weapons that he's made in the woods, and having motorbikes driven into, driven into their faces. It's a thought-provoking movie.
I remember the tree weapons. My older brothers saw it, and they got really into making
tree weapons,
making traps for their little brother. I remember that being the inspiration for that.
Well, there you go.
Thanks, Stallone. That's probably why.
Thanks, John.
Walk near that cowpat, Gary, little Gary Lactus, and they'd put some bangers in it. They'd actually put explosives in it. So I got covered in exploding cow shit.
That's your two brothers, Harry Lactus and Larry Lactus, isn't it?
That's the ones. Yeah, Harry and Larry. Yeah. Oh, couple of cunts.
Couple of cunts.
Yeah. Can you tell me about something you've read?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I read. I bought myself the hardback collection, look at me with my hardback, of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Tempest, the final series, which we talked about intermittently on Silence, usually in a way that where we both talked about it like it was some kind of painful duty to read it, and that we didn't really know, you know, it was not, we were a bit like, I don't know, I remember just being a sort of, you know, liking it, but being a bit like, yeah. And this has been a total revelation. I've been on another Alan Moore little kind of, specifically a League reread, actually. I managed to lose the Black Dossier, which is really frustrating. And it's one of those things where it's like, where has it gone? I've definitely never lent it to anyone. Where the fuck is it? You know, like, you've had this before where we just like, where do these things go? Why have I not got that? Just one of those things that's really like, I have no memory of
that's
ever
still
going,
in print, right? Like, you can get that.
I just had the hardback and I had to get
very,
it. Like,
very difficult for me to get my early 8-ball issues.
Oh, man. It's maddening as well when you, like, sometimes you're like, okay, I remember lending that. And, you know, if you lend something in this world, you just have to accept sometimes it might not come back. But when you definitely haven't and it's just disappeared. Anyway, so I rebought the Black Dossier and I was working my way through that. And then I was like, and I also, because I'd sort of made a little bit of cash selling some stuff on eBay, I was like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to get that volume of The Tempest. And it's been so good reading it like this. I've completely, like, U-turned. I just think it's wonderful. I think it's really amazing. I think the League is incredible, actually. I think what him and Kev have done, Kev O'Neill, is so fun and so clever in so many different ways. It's clever in the way that he's stitched all this kind of, you know, literary sort of pop cultural fictional universe together in a way that actually makes a really kind of excellent kind of sense. And they've brought in everything, you know. I remember, like, when it went from being just like the Victorian stuff, you know, it was like, oh yeah, this all fits together. And it's like halfway through Volume 2, where, like, Mr. Toad turns up, and you're like, ah, he's bringing in Wind of the Willows. That's unexpected. And then it's like, not only is he bringing it in, but it's working brilliantly. It's genuinely terrifying. And it's like, and he's linked it to the Island of Dr. Moreau. And you're like, that's fucking genius. And it showed that the strip could kind of, like, take in, like, children's literature as well. And then it was like, and since then, it's just got wilder and weirder. And why I like Tempest is because it's dealing with, specifically with kind of the history of British comics. And so it's not only is it packed full of, like, little, you know, nods to, well, you know, actual British comic characters, but the format is also is really, you know, playful in that they're constantly, like, aping the styles of British humour comics and, like, all this stuff. So you've got Kevin O'Neill doing his best Leo Baxendale and his best Ken Reeds and stuff. And then you've got this backup strip, which is, I don't think I even quite registered that, you know, the Seven Stars strip is, first of all, it's kind of pastiche of duff British superheroes. There's, you know, riffing on American superheroes in a slightly stodgier way.
But it's actually, they're genuine ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're genuine.
No, they're all genuine. Yeah, yeah, they're all, and a lot of them are, you know, as was the case, tend to just be rip-offs of, you know, Captain Marvel and stuff like that, and Buck Rogers and things like that. So, but yeah, no, they're all legit. They're all real, and it's like a real sort of mining of a completely forgotten British, superhero lineage, really. And so it's really fun. But also, I'd never even picked up that it's like, it's Mina. Mina is like, is Vol the Invisible, who's one of the characters, and she's just, because she's invisible, they just don't realise it's Mina. And so it was like, for a brief while in the sort of 50s or 60s, she formed a super team called the Seven Stars, and that's the adventure you're reading is about. So it's kind of this other, slightly shittier league that kind of, but it's all done as this kind of weird superhero comic, which also seems to be a comment on the whole, I mean, this was pointed out by Jeff Lester on Wait What, the podcast, but the whole of The Tempest seems to be a bit of a comment on Grant Morrison's Seven Soldiers, in that the plot mirrors it really closely, the whole idea of this seven sort of soldiers superhero team being convened to combat like the waging of war of fairyland. Well, that's exactly what happens in this, but in The Tempest, Prospero is kind of releases the madness of fairy in these fictional things into this fictional reality and destroys the world and wins, basically. And obviously Prospero is sort of Alan Moore. And, Seven Soldiers has got, like, this whole dig at Alan Moore with him being the rogue time tailor, you know, the bearded one. It's just a, quite a funny and reasonably playful, considering how much he apparently loathes Morrison, I think, response. But anyway, but it's just been so good. It's been really, I've been so into it. And, like, the way that Kevin O'Neill is just, like, it's such an incredible artist. It's like, I think my thing was that reading through it, I was just like, it's so churlish to not just go, this is just really fucking good comics, whether you get getting all the references or not. And I'm not, you know, most of the time. A couple of times I've gone and looked it up on the internet. Oh, who is that? That's bugging me. But a lot of the time it's like, you know, doesn't matter too much. You know, just have fun with just how well done it is and how fucking excellent Kevin O'Neill's artwork is and how well they're working together as a creative team and just how this story that he's told, this league story, has just grown and become like this immersive, complete vision of a kind of, it's like it is a parlor game, but it's also not, it's just really joyous. It's like a really joyous creative act, I think. And it's he's found a way to comment on all sorts of things, you know, about, you know, this is the Tempest is really, considering it's his goodbye to comics, it's really, you know, it's really critical of the British comic industry, explicitly, and how it just treated these mad geniuses so terribly. I've been loving it, and it's a complete revelation reading it in like one volume, because it makes a lot more sense than I gave it credit for. It's not hard to follow. It's incredibly dense and rewarding and playful and fun and just excellent and scary and weird and mind bending. Yeah. And yeah, just love it, basically. It's great. Oh, I believe. Can you hear me? Hello?
You're breaking up. A lot.
That's okay. Yeah, we'll just have to. I talked coherently. You can just edit out the bit where we're talking now.
Or just allow the listener a tantalizing peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, they haven't had many of those. Yeah, but anyway, it's just brilliant. The league. I'm completely back into it, and
it's presented as the comics were. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's just
it
issue.
It hasn't recollected like the
no.
Sort of,
no, it hasn't separated out the things. And all the 3D stuff I've really been enjoying, even though it's a pain in the ass when you have to wear your reading glasses and your 3D glasses. But it is really good. And there's loads of extra bits, and it's all put together very lovingly and basically just is excellent.
Yeah, yeah. I do wonder if that... What do you think it could have gained from monthly release?
I think probably they got to play around with the format and, you know, present them as all these different takes on British, you know, standard British comics like the Girls Weekly or the Illustrated, you know, Classics Illustrated or TV21. It was, you know, there was a certain... And I think because it is very much about comics, I think they wanted to do it as a, therefore as a comic, because it's very much about the kind of weekly the weekly grind changing. And yeah, exactly. But I do think it's, you know, it's always better to read this stuff, you know, in a more considered way, instead of just like on the fly, you know, falling asleep halfway through an issue, trying to work your way through it or whatever, you know, because
I think that was a big problem for me, because
me too.
It'd be like there'd be this sort of crazy dense thing, and it would be a floppy comic wasn't enough to get fully immersed, and you kind of have to, or I do anyway, I need to sort of spend a certain amount of time in a fictional universe to start remembering, you know, stuff from Black Dossier.
Oh, absolutely.
From, 2009.
The thing is, they really, like, the league is just this kind of really dense, like, interlinked thing. Because just reading the Black Dossier and Tempest sort of at the same time, you know, in the Black Dossier, there's this missing, lost Shakespeare play, the fragment of it, called The Fairies Found Fortune, whatever it is, it's about like Gloriana, the fairy queen, forming Prospero's League, and there's this whole thing about how it's like the fairy ploy to sort of essentially set up what happens at the end of the Tempest, and it's like, yeah, I had no idea when you're reading the Black Dossier that that's what that's about. And then in the Tempest, Mina and the latest iteration of Nemo find themselves watching a fairy performance of that sort of play. And Mina is, during that performance, Mina realizes what's happening, and that she realizes there's this whole bit where it's talking about essentially her, you know, and it's like this Shakespeare play where it's referring to, you know, the time that Mina will lead the league. And she's like, holy shit. Oh, wait a minute, this is not right. And it's like, oh, wow, this is amazing. This all is amazing. The way he's kind of thought this through, and, you know, the way it links. But, you know, if I wasn't reading those together, I wouldn't even remember that happened in the league. I wouldn't, you know, in the Black Dossier, I just wouldn't have any memory of that. I've got no memory. It's only because I'm reading it all. But then again, it's like, that's kind of the joy of really good comics, is you should want to reread them. And I, you know, I have really enjoyed, this has made me go, oh, I'm just going to reread all the league. I'm going to go back and read all the Nemo ones. And, you know, because, you know, those Nemo editions, they came out and I like those, but I didn't go back and go, let's do them again. But it's like, fucking hell, you know, each of those is like 48 pages of crazy. And the good thing about those Nemo ones is that they were like Alan Moore saying to Kevin O'Neill, okay, I'll give you a break. You can just draw loads of fun stuff and I'll make it less, you know, punishing. Mm. And so they're much more of a sort of fun artist showcase, I think. And it's just great. It's completely made me go back to the league and go, you know what, this is the good shit. Alan Moore's, you know what, he's really good at comics, right? Gary Lapdus, did you know that?
Oh, well, the more people tell me, the more I try and find ways to find that he's not. but, you know, yeah, it is hard. It's a hard job, but I'm really, I am a hero for doing it. No, I've bought all of Tempest. I haven't read it. I am inspired to do so by your enthusiasm. Whether I'll get the time. I mean, I've just bought Monsters.
Did you?
Smith, right, 380 thing. I mean, I've made a start on that. That's a lot. I mean, do you know what? He's quite good at drawing.
Yeah, Yeah.
What I like about it so far, it's, I like that it's black and white.
Right.
I like that it has sensible, it doesn't have the silly baroque, ooh, look at me, I'm a comics page panel layouts. It's just like, no, we're telling a story here.
Mm.
And so it is, it has that sort of ease of immersion, you know. It's a real bugbear of mine, actually, that comics panel layout, like, oh look, and it actually makes a shape which is relevant to what's happening, or even like in the case of, like, I bought Wonder Woman Earth 1-3, and just the pointless fucking squiggly bits around these panels is just, I mean, I haven't got through it yet. I will, but I mean, I'm not into it. But yeah, no, I'm enjoying what, you know, the few pages I've read of Monsters so far.
It looks beautiful.
I shouldn't talk about it, incredible. But I think it's a must have. I mean, just out of respect for someone who took 35 years doing a thing and, you know, sort of gave up doing whatever.
Making money.
Machine Man. Yeah, yeah, basically. Oh, I'm sure he made money. We had a little discussion about this on the Silence Facebook page, didn't we? I'm sure he's been doing fine out of commissions whilst putting this together. I don't think he has been, starving in any way. But it sure is a lot of drawing. And, I'm looking forward to reading the whole thing.
Mm.
And, I'd be curious to see what you think. And, I think you'd be into it as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm
just
gonna get it.
In terms of the horror tropes, the atmosphere. Barry Windsor Smith is, he can tell a story in such a solid way, and he can, and the dialogue isn't embarrassing or anything. It seems pretty well researched, Yeah, it really does have. It's emotionally resonant, even though it's sort of. I guess maybe it's a bit button pushy. It's using lots of familiar tropes, but it just works. It's just.
What do you mean, button pushy? Like, as in manipulative, sort of.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're going to feel this about this character, because I've shown you this. I'm really trying not to, you know, spoil anything for anyone, but you know, and this kind of shit here that I'm showing you. I mean, that's going to be a sort of emotional trigger for anyone, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's not complicated. But it's just done so well. And
yeah, I mean, he literally is one of the, you know, one of the fucking mediums.
Yeah, one of the first artists I've really noticed, you know, with that Machine Man backup in UK Transformers. It's like, holy shit, I love this guy.
Mm.
And he was really in control as well. He did his own colouring. He mixed, the little, you've got to cut out bits of acetate, for, you know, to delineate different bits of colour and stuff. And he mixed them like no one else, these sort of grey purples. And the way he used that was just unlike anything else that you were seeing in comics. Yeah, and now he's actually got to, you know, do something he wants to do, you know. I mean, well, not that he wants to. I'm sure he wanted to, you know. He's clearly a fan of comics, but he's doing his own thing. He's not, you know, he's writing it himself, and it's written pretty well. And yeah, he's not just you know, putting a ridiculous amount of effort into something that's, you know, he's going to get one payment for, and then that's it.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think it's a bit like donating to someone's GoFundMe or something. It's like, you know, it's just, but the bonus of that is you get a fucking massive wodge of really amazing comics out of it, even if, you know, it doesn't resonate at all. It's like, holy shit, I need to buy this. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. But it is. It's good. It, you know, I am hooked.
yeah, but, it's not your greens. It's not duty.
Maybe I should talk about that when I've read it.
Could do. Why not?
Like, much as I have read, the real the surprise hit of today's lawn pickup was Girl. I've got a couple from 1982 and a couple from 1987. The ones from 1982 are Girl and Dreamer. IPC, King's Reach Tower. This is coming out of the same place as 2000 AD. It's really, really heavy on the photo strips, which I was very, very happy about.
Oh, yeah. That's the good shit.
Girl. 29th of May, 1982. Every Thursday, number 68. 22p. Girl and Dreamer. Your very best friend. Sad photo story. That's a selling point. Sad photo story.
Yeah.
Has Debbie found a home for all her donkeys? Find out inside. Haven't actually read that one, but I am looking forward to it. The spent a fair amount of time with a Girl from 17th of January 1987, every Thursday, number 310. This is a bit like, you know, when you were talking about Atlas Comics. You got a bunch of Atlas comics, and you were talking about it was like reading stuff from a parallel universe.
Yeah.
This is, you know, this is my childhood. I was a child back then. It's a period of time I remember, but it's like a parallel universe where I was a girl reading comics. And they're pretty good. They are, I've got to tell you, from what I've read of these and from the very little I've read of the football comics, Girls comics were pretty good. In this issue, one that really caught my eye was The Magic Walkman. On her new personal stereo, Sharon picked up two robbers planning a raid. No one except Ben believed her. But together they traced the men and arranged a meeting over Ben's brother's CB set. Mandy went to meet the men alone and disappeared. It was 3 a.m. She's tied up in the back of a car with these two blokes. This is a photo strip. Here, what's the idea of bringing her along on the job, Den? Well, I thought we'd done the job. I thought when we'd done the job, we could leave her tied up in the old shop with the old boy. Like it, Den, like it. Yeah, I thought you might, Colin, old son. Thought you might. Is this it, Den? Yeah, just round the corner from the shop. You gonna leave her in the car, Den? Yeah. There's no one about at this time. Nice, quiet residential district. I'll make sure the gag's nice and tight. So she's tied up. They go off to rob an antique shop. Meanwhile, She can't get loose from her ties, but her Walkman manages to fall off her belt, and she takes the tape out and manages to put it in the car stereo and turn it up. It's a Motorhead tape. So she plays loud. She plays really loud Motorhead. Instantly, the neighbourhood woke up. The neighbourhood woke up as it was bombarded with heavy metal music. And there's a sort of really odd picture of an old lady in a hairnet in bed, which looks like they, I don't know, they didn't light it properly, but it's the best one and they've had to use it. The music had the desired effect. Fred, wake up! Listen to that racket! Now I'm expected to sleep with that How am I expected to sleep with that going on? I'm calling the police! But not everyone minded, and you've got some hairy guy here who's playing air guitar in his pyjamas. He's going, "Hey man, Motorhead, this is the most fantastic dream I've ever had. It feels like it's for real." And he's clearly likes heavy metal because he's got a Peter Gabriel poster on his wall. And anyway, the police come along and they get them. So you've got these two people. They've just been nicked. And they're being taken off by the police. One policeman, two blokes, by the way. They're coming quietly. They're just all the expressions are just... I mean, I really can't do it justice in this audio form. Anyway, the policeman says, "Anyway, let's get you two tucked up for the night. Hang on, copper. There's just one thing I got to know first." And he turns to the girl and says, "Tell me, will you, what's a nice girl like you doing with a Motorhead cassette?" "Well, it's a rather long story." But then her mum turns up and we don't get... I mean, that might have happened in a previous episode. What I like about girl... Oh, there we go. No, straight after that, know your Nick Kamen. He died last week, didn't he?
He did, Nick Kamen.
It doesn't. There is nothing from this sample. There is no Judge Dredd. There is no desire for anything, you know, sort of long running. There's no canon. It's just like you've got lots of done in one stories, which is satisfying. You've got a few sort of like two or three parters, but that's it. And it just moves along. And the you know, the editorial on the letters page is great. I was reading this one from 1982. These, I think, must be clearly made up letters. Postbox. Clever talk. "My mum's great. But she sometimes drives me crazy the way she talks to herself all the time. One evening, I was trying in vain to watch Top of the Pops, and she was rabbiting away to herself as usual. 'Oh, Mum, why do you always talk to yourself?' I asked her, annoyed. 'Because it's the only way I get a sensible answer,' she replied, quick as a flash. Lisa Roten." a figure of speech. My big sis was about to go out. She told Mum she'd probably be back around midnight and asked if Mum would wait up for her. Mum replied that, as there was nothing much on telly, 10 to 1, she'd go to bed. 'Oh, good,' said my dopey sister. 'I'll be in well before that.'" What a sis.
I'm
10
obsessed.
To 1 being the odds rather than the time.
I'm obsessed by the kind of window into the past that letters pages are. Like the window to like how well behaved children seem to be in the past and just how absurdly innocent they seem to be. And sometimes it's because editors were writing them, you realise, that's why.
Yeah, this one, I think this one had a couple of passes because unlike the last one, this one, it seems like they've needed to qualify it a bit. When I was born, my dad came straight to the hospital to take a first peek at me. At the nurse, a nurse met him at the door, saying, "You have a lovely baby girl. She's £7.15. My daft dad only got out his wallet and started counting out the notes. He was so excited, he thought that she was talking about money, not weight. Denise, Glasgow. And the editors are Kim and Debbie. I could just pore over this stuff all day. There's some full colour photo stories there. That's a rare one. Oh, who's that? Oh, it's Cliff Richard. Cliff Richard next to Gary Newman and Funboy 3. It's the most wonderful mix of pictures. Some of the artwork is good as well. In the later one, there's a, of course, uncredited Patty's World. Really quite nice art. I'd love to know who drew Patty's World, because it's got a nice sort of modern style. Hard to describe, but very pleasing. It's got the sort of, you know, the sort of abstracted hair that was common in sort of 70s line-drawn advertising.
Yeah.
It's got some of that, but it's 1987. It's like a sort of weird, updated version of that. Like a sort of stylistic dead end that never went anywhere.
What's the strip called?
Patty's World.
Patty with a Y?
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up so that I can see if I can find out who drew it and see if there's some... drawn by Purita Campos. So I'm assuming it's one of the sort of Spanish... artists that were employed a lot in these. It's really nice. Yeah, it's really bold. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's lovely. I know what you mean about the hair. It's sort of, yeah. Mm. Gosh, it's really good.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a real turn-up, a real pleasurable turn-up for me. Girl. From the 80s.
I mean...
It would have been all right being a girl, I think.
Yeah, but just because of the comics, not for any other reason. Of the rebellion, like the British Treasury of British Comics Library or whatever it is, the stuff they're reprinting from the girls' comics is, if I didn't just loathe Rebellion's design and reprint quality, I just hate the way that it's like they just haven't paid a graphic designer at all. And so, why does this look so shit? And why have you printed it on glossy paper? And why is it like a horrible scan where you've lost all the detail? Anyway, but that's because they haven't got the original art. I get that. You know, it's limited and stuff. But
there's ways around that. If you're really going to invest in it. There was a huge like reproduction done of some Doctor Who stuff. Doctor Who reprints didn't have the original art.
Mm. Was that for that Dalek, the painted Dalek strip?
No, it wasn't. This was a few years ago. This was some Dave Gibbons art being sort of really quite lovingly restored. But that's the sort of level of attention one gets from Doctor Who, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, well, yeah. But no, anyway, all I was going to say is that the girls' comic stuff does look way more interesting than a lot of the other stuff that comes out. You know, it's just always just like, just tonally, it's so different, you know, still really melodramatic and exciting, but it's just going for a different atmosphere than, you know, 90% of the boys' comics were.
It's sort of liberated from continuity and canon and things like this, these sort of, these unpleasant influences.
Yeah, and it's just like these endless, like, girls in peril sort of storylines are really fascinating as well. There's a real sort of quasi sadism to them, you know, in that, like, there's quite a lot of strips about, like, you know, poor put upon orphan girls being really put through the ringer in ways, you know, every week was, you know, they're sort of suffering. But well, I remember there was a strip in Battle called The Nightmare, which was about a boy who was like a war orphan and his dog, and it just was like every week it was just like, it was just shit gets worse and worse for this kid, and you know, he ended up, it all culminated in some crazy climax inside a like Nazi castle and stuff, but it definitely was like, I realise now that it was riffing on the girls comics model, that was, because that is what a lot of that stuff's like. And there is that in kind of young adult fiction. There is a certain kind of cruelty and sadism and stuff, because, you know, I guess that sort of is, but there is quite a large amount of that in your childhood. It's just, you know, we often try and forget it, but, you know, kids are pretty horrible to each other. They, you know, they can really sort of torture each other in ways. So I wonder if it's a sort of refraction of that. But yeah, I definitely think there's a bloodthirstiness to girls' comics that is just sort of filtered in a different way. Less explosions and gung-ho stuff, and more kind of you're trapped inside a haunted ballet school with an evil governess kind of stuff, which is really, yeah. There's a sort of strange link to, I don't know, almost like giallo. It's that kind of, like, I could almost see a lineage from some of this stuff to you know, Suspiria, for example. But that's just me stretching it a bit, probably.
Well, what I've liked about reading The Girl, particularly the photo strips, is how grounded the stories are. The stories about bullying. There's there's a story about a girl who was bullied, and then her bully came to her. She was bullied so badly she had to leave school, change schools, and then her bully came to their school and she wanted revenge. And what happened, the final straw for our poor protagonist, was that she was going to do a ballet recital, and she was so excited about it. But her bully had attached a long string to her tutu and pulled her tutu off, and it was terribly embarrassing. And so she thought she'd get her own back, and now she was going to you know, possibly get expelled. And it doesn't really resolve itself. It's just this sort of little study in social interaction and learning about people and how people behave and power dynamics. And it doesn't, as I say, it doesn't resolve. But there's this surreal thing of like, she tied a string to my tutu and I couldn't prove anything.
Yeah.
There was a massive string there. It's literally a trail, like, you know, of evidence. But and so it makes these sort of omissions make it kind of surreal. I know probably none of this is intentional, and the uncredited writers were just like, it's just for kids, fuck it. You know, whatever 40 something, you know, 40 a day fag smoking bloke was who was writing it thought. But it's just such a different reading experience. I've really, really enjoyed them.
Yeah,
I'm glad I've got a few more. I'm really looking forward to
getting hold
of
some copies of Jinty and stuff like that. Actually, I was just looking at the sort of resource for girls' comics, and the names of the strips are so good. Pam of Pond Hill, that's one strip. Gay's Gloomy Ghost, that's another one. Badgered Belinda.
Badgered Belinda.
Yeah. It's fucking great.
Yes, please.
Yeah, there's a good resource called jintycomic.wordpress.com that is basically someone running down every issue of Jinty, as far as I can see. And thank God that someone's done that, because you know, that's a good thing. So yeah,
and that's Girl Comic.
Girl Comic. I like Girl Comic.
Hmm. Anything else the Beast must
well
die?
I did have some stuff, but we've gone quite long really, so I don't know. I think I maybe rather than half ass it, I'll just save it.
I actually read some Nth Man the Ultimate Ninja in
prep.
Preparation. But you know, maybe we can do that another time.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I do love that comic. I tell you what I did get in amongst some 50p tat. I got a little tat haul from Krypton Comics, and one of the things I picked up is a comic called Silver Blade, which I've always been fascinated by. It's like a DC miniseries, of course, from the 80s, of course, by Cary Bates, who's one of those strange writers who, you know... a very weird writer, basically, wrote some very odd Flash comics. It's drawn by Gene Colan. It's a 12-issue maxi series. And it's basically about a guy called Jonathan Lord, who is an actor from the golden era of Hollywood, who seems... I've only got, like, issue two, so I missed the setup. But I think it seems like he comes back... from the dead, maybe, but he's sort of come back as a younger version of himself. So he, in order to convince the public, he's basically presenting himself as Jonathan Lord's long lost son. So everyone's just like, oh, this is the son of this actor who looks exactly like him. But he seems to have some superpower, which means... so he's dressed as a guy...
It's Man in the Iron Mask, it seems, sort of.
Well, it's sort of... Silver Blade is a character he played in a film, a sort of swashbuckling character. So that's like his go-to sort of superhero outfit. But his power is that he can become any character from a film. So he sort of turns into a mummy at some point, and then and he turns into a boxer when he's having a fight with somebody. He turns into like, but it's all like, you know, sort of movie. The whole thing's like a love letter to golden age Hollywood, but with this really odd kind of quirky superhero take, but it's all done like really quite with quite a lot of care and like attention. So the inside cover is an article about Jonathan Lord, the forgotten idol, positioning him as you know, essentially an equivalent, a peer of Errol Flynn and Tyrone Power, and it's all written as though it's a sort of, you know, an actual article. And so it's like, it's not like tossed off. It's really, and Gene Colan's art is really, really, it was an acquired taste. I'd put it like Mark Badger. I was always put off by it because it seemed too loose, and I was just like, oh, it's a bit rough and ready. But I've really grown to love it. It's sort of impressionistic, and once you kind of click into it, it's really addictive in a way.
Mm.
He is better when he's inked by... I mean, Steve Mitchell's inking him, and I don't love Steve Mitchell's inks in general. The best Gene Colan I've seen is Klaus Janson inking him on Gem, Son of Saturn. But anyway, it's still really good, and I like it. It is an acquired taste, but it's like... he's wonderful, and this is just a genuinely quirky, odd thing that I just sort of love. I love its conceit. I like the way it's been done. I like how ludicrously uncommercial it is. You know, like what an obvious like commercial stinker it is. But it's really good. It's curious, and I enjoyed it. And also, there's an interesting thing. In the back, there is an advert for the Doc Savage revamp. Do you remember, like, Denny O'Neill revamped Doc Savage? Then they did a four-issue series, and then they put a series out around the time of the Savage, the Shadow Returns, or Shadow Strikes. It was that sort of... they got hold of some pulp properties and basically put out some stuff. Now, I... always was quite intrigued by the advert for it, because it's got this, you probably remember it, it's got a window and you're looking in through the window and there's a guy sat in a chair. Actually, I'm posturally echoing him exactly, that's quite weird. He's got his feet up on the desk and he's got a smoking gun in his hand. He looks like a private dick of some sort, but he's also got ripped t-shirt, sleeveless sort of t-shirt, and a ponytail. And he's sort of got dark hair and possibly... not white. You know, there's a suggestion through the colouring. Maybe he basically sort of feels like he might be like Native American or something. And I was always like, all right, I wonder what that is. But when the comic came out, it wasn't. He did revise it some. He did sort of flip it and do some 80s revisionism on the mythos. But it was essentially Doc Savage. And by all accounts, his original plan was that like Doc Savage would incarnate in the body of a Native American private eye. And that was going to be his take. A bit like, I guess, you know, Helfer was running fast and loose with the Shadow. And I guess maybe they were like, well, fuck it, let's do something weird and wild with Doc Savage. And so this advert is the only suggestion of what that was going to be, and it's got nothing to do with the comic that then came out. And I just read about this because I was like, I've always been intrigued, and I sort of thought I'd read about the series and see if it was any cop or whatever. And I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? It's like, so it was basically sort of published, you know, but the advert was sort of suggesting something that never played out. And the tagline is, it says, Doc Savage, he's not who you think he is, which then didn't have any bearing on the comic because it was who you thought it was. It was Doc Savage.
Yes, Doc Savage, yeah.
Anyway, it's just one of those little kind of curious things. But yeah, that's it. I've actually got some...
Sorry, what was that comic?
Oh, Silver Blade was the comic that I was reviewing. I did read some actual Bond Destiny for the first time. I really got into it, but I'll talk about that maybe next week because it probably deserves a bit more consideration.
next week,
you know,
yeah.
It's like a dog year. It's like a month. Next month, me done.
Yeah, we recording God Weeks.
Yeah, God Weeks. Yeah. I don't have any more.
Well then,
let me sing our way out.
Yes. Let's run away from the universe to the toilet. And thank you so much for joining us, dear listener. What a special dear listener you are. Yes, you. What else? Oh, I forgot to mention, of course, the Starlight Adventures, Dan and Fraser's Starlight Adventures, is another thing you can get on Patreon.
Did you not mention that in your spiel? My God, that's the best thing.
No, I didn't. I know, it's the best thing we've ever done. It's better than this. I really hope we get to record another one soon.
We will.
Because it is the best fun. And also, I want to get through that
Star
first
Riders.
Book.
Yeah, I reckon Star the next Rider. One's... I reckon
because
the next
because
be
Lady Lactus is like, can we read another one? Can we read another one? It's like, I can't... Sorry, darling, I can't finish this. I can't do that until I've finished reading it with my old pal... Dan.
For our commercial endeavour.
Yeah. Until next time, enjoy everything you do. And as the world opens up, let's hope that you'll open up to us again. Now it's legal to hug again. In the UK.
Now Boris Johnson has told us how to hug. And yes. We all know that when he hugs people, babies happen. So, yeah, be careful out there.
Now that the day before a bunch of elections, there was this lovely cuddly news about, oh, we can hug again. Isn't that lovely? Aren't the Conservatives brilliant?
Yeah.
Next time. We throughout the whole of COVID, dear listener, we have been hugging you constantly every week with our voices and our thoughts on comics. Don't let Boris Johnson tell you how to hug. Listen to us. We know how to hug. We hug you by talking about stuff from the late 80s, early 90s, revisionist material, curious British comics, and occasionally the odd contemporary thing. Here on Silence!